afternoon, and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. I'll be talking today with Al Letson about his solo show at the Marsh. You'll also hear about CMT San Jose's production of Hairspray from director Kevin Hauge. Amy Lewis and John Landini talk about their Soma Now and Then, a walking tour with dance. And we'll usher in the holiday season with a discussion with Amy Seiwert about this year's Smuin Christmas Ballet. Plus, regular commentator Peter Robinson shares his take on other happenings in the Bay Area, holiday and otherwise. Stay with us. The Marsh, San Francisco, presents NPR host Al Letson in his acclaimed solo show, Summer in Sanctuary, an autobiographical narrative that chronicles Al's summer working as a creative writing teacher at the Sanctuary on 8th Street, a community center in an economically challenged neighborhood in Jacksonville, Florida. Al challenges perceptions about race and class as he struggles to connect with disadvantaged children of the Sanctuary. KLW listeners know Al's voice as the host of State of the Reunion and now Reveal, which is heard on Mondays at 11 a.m. His rising star as a radio host and producer started with his winning the Public Radio Talent Quest competition out of more than 1,400 applicants. His show was one of three chosen to be funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. State of the Reunion aired on more than 200 radio stations and earned three consecutive Edward R. Murrow Awards, as well as a Peabody. He then moved to the Center for Investigative Reporting to host Reveal Radio, which garnered another Peabody, and his work on The Dead Unknown earned him a News and Documentary Emmy Award for New Approaches for Current News Coverage. Al, such a pleasure to welcome you on today's show and to the Thursday afternoon end of KLW's airwaves.
Hey, glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, Summer in Sanctuary made its start as part of a project at the Marsh Rising this past April. Is that correct?
Yeah. So, you know, Marsh Rising is a place where you get to, like, put your stuff up and kind of workshop it a little bit, let the staff at the Marsh see what you're doing. So, I did it in April. I've done this play before, but, you know, I'm just now moving out to the Bay in the last 2 years or so, and I haven't done any theater out here, so I wanted to bring this piece out. So, yeah, I did The Marsh Rising, and thankfully The Marsh loved it. They're beautiful, amazing people, and here we go.
And that actually started out as a State of the Reunion episode, I believe.
Yeah, so I did the play, and then we did a State of the Reunion episode a couple years ago. I mean, the play I started writing probably like 4 or 5 years ago now. And so the State of the Reunion episode came pretty soon after I first started writing it.
Well, you're such a wonderful storyteller, and this show really gives you a chance to display all of your many talents.
Yeah, I have a good time. Like, I love the stage. You know, when I first got into radio, I wasn't sure if I loved it. But the stage, it's always been, you know, my favorite place. Now, like, I love them equally. Like, I love talking to people on the radio and podcasts, but being on stage and being able to do spoken word and jump around and act silly, I love to poke fun at myself because I'm an idiot. doing all that stuff, like, it's really fun on stage.
Well, your style is so sound rich, and, you know, your award-winning work on radio on both State of the Reunion and Reveal are products of a lot of love and passion, as well as, no doubt, a lot of time in the editing room. And live theater is a different kind of baby, I guess.
It is. I mean, you know, like, they're very different beasts. What I love about radio and podcasting is that you can be really, really personal to people. Like right now, as I'm talking to you, like, I am imagining myself talking specifically to you, but also to, like, every individual listener. Like, I'm not talking to a mass of people. I'm talking to the individual. And it's pretty rare in that format that you get a lot of feedback from that type of work. I mean, yeah, every now and then you get an email or maybe a tweet here or there, but for the most part, you generally do that work, you send it out into the world and just is what it is. With theater, though, it's so different because every performance I do at the Marsh, like, it feels a little bit different because the audience is different, and I feel like it's a conversation. And so, you know, I'm the one like doing a lot of the talking, but the way the audience responds to the work definitely feels like they are responding to me. So I love that, and you know, I am as a performer and as a middle child, I have an addiction to clap cocaine. So when people clap for me, like, it gives me that high, you know. So the Marsh totally feeds my clap cocaine addiction.
Well, this your addiction, so to speak, comes, and your engaging with audiences comes from being a servant at some point in your life. You were airline host at one point of your life. You seem to enjoy interacting with people.
I do. I am really interested in people's stories. I'm interested in telling my story. I think that the only way that we make change in the world is through the stories that we tell. I think you can look at stories that have been handed down from, you know, way back from what's in the Bible, to the Quran, to the Torah, all sorts of religious texts. You see these stories have been handed down, and they were stories that, you know, tried to speak about morality and the way the world was at that time. And I think that by engaging in my story, but also engaging in other people's story, you really begin to understand the world, but you can also change the world. So for me, yeah, I really enjoy like people and being around them and doing my thing.
Well, your stories on both State of the Reunion and Reveal are really engaging. I mean, for me personally, it's created more than one public radio garage moment. You know, when you're in the driveway, you can't quite get out of the car.
And yeah, that's the beauty of public radio, man. Is that like you can just reach in and give somebody something, and you know, if you craft it well enough, if it connects with them in some way, you can really like take people to a different place.
Summer in Sanctuary is calling attention to an really underreported fact, what you're calling a dropout epidemic, in this case in Jacksonville, just being one example.
Yeah, I mean, you know, all over the country, you know, dropout rates, you know, they definitely go up and down. But, you know, we're at a place now where I think we should be concentrating and looking at it. I think, you know, the biggest thing with Summer in Sanctuary for me is as a young African-American man, when I went into the sanctuary, I come from a pretty middle class background. And I just thought I understood poverty in this way. I guess at the time, I guess I thought I understood it like through osmosis. Like, you know, I'd had some family members that financially weren't as well off as we were. And, you know, you see it on TV. Of course, you have friends that are there. But, you know, you don't really know it. And working at the sanctuary was sort of a lesson on what poverty is and what that means and how it changes everything. And including, you know, education, including, you know, safety and the way these children had to live their lives. So for me, like, the piece is really about, you know, a window into a world that I just really didn't know. And hopefully, you know, I can bring theater goers into that world with me.
Well, tell us about some of the kids you've reached.
Sure. So that year, in actuality, when I was at the sanctuary, I was probably working with somewhere around 10 to 12 kids. For the sake of doing it in theater, I only concentrate on like four or five of those kids. Just because, you know, doing 10 or 12 kids is pretty tough to wrangle on stage. But there's Biko. I can like actually let you hear the characters.
Yeah, let me hear a couple of them. Sure, that'd be great.
So Biko is, yo, Al, man, why you talking about me on the radio? You know, that would be Biko. Biko is kind of like the star of the show with me. He is the kid that I connected the most with. He's an immigrant. He's from the Congo. And he was living in the ghettos of Jacksonville and living his life as to the best he can. And so all of this happened when Biko was about 14. At this point, Biko is, you know, a young man and he's doing well in his life. So there, besides Biko, there is Alonzo. And Alonzo is a big kid. He's like 14, but he's like 5'9" and really stocky. And Alonzo would say, What, Al, man? What? I be looking at you like that because you be acting crazy. Jokes, Al. Jokes.
Then there was Duran, and Duran is a young man of very few words, and he would just say, whatever. And then last but not least, there was Little Chris, and Little Chris reminded me a lot of myself because he's really small, but he has this big mouth that just does not stop.
Hey, yo, Al, man, why you always picking on me, man? Everybody always picking on me, man. Why you come on the radio and tell people that I'm small, man? I ain't small.
You know, so, like, those are the ensemble of characters that hang out with me on this journey.
Well, that's great. Well, in addition to the multiple characters, are you also bringing some of your radio chops in terms of some sound rich that we'll hear in the background?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I had I worked with a DJ / hip hop producer, Willie Evans Jr. And we have our own little podcast that we put out, you know, every blue moon. It's called Earthine because we get to do Earthine we want to do. But him and I have been doing a lot of work on stage and both in podcasting as well. So he scored most of the story as well. And then, you know, like I think that like in my performance, I'm constantly thinking about like the sounds that I'm making and using on stage to help bring people in.
And are you still in touch with some of these kids in Jacksonville?
Yeah, I'm in touch with, through the magic of Facebook, I talked to Biko, Alonzo, and Duran. You know, at least once every couple months, we check in with each other. There have been years when, like, you know, maybe it was once a year. But, yeah, like, every now and then we catch up. We used to, before I moved out here, like, every holiday we would get together and have dinner. Chris, I don't keep in touch with him at all. He's not, I don't think he's on Facebook, but Chris, you know, is the one kid that kind of slipped through the cracks and, you know, ended up in jail a lot. So I have seen him, and I've made an effort to reach out to him, but you know, he's doing his own thing.
So are you looking at Jacksonville and the dropout situation as just a microcosm of what's happening nationally? Are you seeing other areas that are as affected?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, poverty plays out different ways in different places. I think that Jacksonville, for me, it was an eye-opening experience. But I think that you can apply it all over the country. It just may look a little bit different.
Well, among the tunes that you've incorporated into Sanctuary, Summer in Sanctuary, is Barry White's Can't Get Enough of Your Love. tell us how that figures into the equation.
Yeah, so Barry White comes in at a point when... So a lot of this story is both about... One of the things I wanted to reflect is my upbringing as a middle-class black kid against these kids' upbringing as really, you know, kids that are struggling in poverty, and like how the two things are really different. So there's a lot of flashbacks between, you know, my life as a kid. And so that one comes in at a... certain, I don't want to spoil it, but it comes in at a certain point of my childhood and looking back at, you know, my goofiness. I was a pretty goofy kid.
Summer in Sanctuary runs through November 26th on Fridays at 8, Saturdays at 8:30. Information at themarsh.org.
And we actually just extended it. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut
you off.
No, go
ahead, please.
Yeah, we actually just extended it, and literally like today we just figured out that we were going to do it. So it'll be running... all through December on Saturdays at 8:30, and then in January it'll be back on Fridays and Saturdays at 8, and 8 on Fridays and 8:30 on Saturdays.
Fantastic. Well, the schedule can be seen at themarsh.org. Al, thank you for your work that we're hearing all the time here on KALW, and looking forward to catch the show.
Hey, man, I love KALW. It is the funkiest public radio station ever.
We tried.
And, much love to you, and thank you for having me on.
Cheers.
Bye.
Girl, I don't know why. Can't get enough of your love, babe. Lord, some things I can't get used to. No matter how I try. It's like the more you give, the more I want. And baby, that's no lie. Oh, no, babe. Tell me, what can I say? Should I feel with everything in you? What kind of love is this that you're giving me? Is it in your kiss or just because you
Barry White can't get enough of your... Let me work on my Barry White voice there. There we are. Can't get enough of your love. A perfect segue, even though it's as part of the Marsh's production of Summer in Sanctuary with Al Letts, and it segues nicely to my next segment here on Open Air. Good afternoon, David LaTulip with you. And a friendly advisement for this next segment, if sensitive ears are listening, the following Open Air segment will be dealing with some adult subject matter, and the mention of certain sexual acts will be as delicately couched as possible. There's the advisement. Push Up Something Hidden, P-U-S-H, Push, is proud to announce the world premiere of Soma Now and Then, presenting one man's journey through San Francisco, south of Market's back alleys and secret rooms, as the neighborhood's queer culture shifts from the heyday of Leathermen and today's tech boom. Through choreographed movement and personal anecdote, artist Joe Landini leads audiences on a walking tour of the neighborhood. This show was conceived and directed by Push founding director Amy Lewis. Amy began making dance in the Bay Area in 2005 after receiving a BA in theater from UCLA and MFA in dance from Mills College. Push serves as a vehicle for Amy's collaborations with many other artists, and their most recent project, Six Suites, premiered at the Community Music Center in 2016, featured the work of more than a half a dozen dance artists, including Lewis, set to the music of Bach's Suites for Unaccompanied Cello. Welcome back to Open Air, Amy.
Thank you.
And Joe Landini is the founder and director of Safe House. Safe stands for Save Art from Extinction for the Performing Arts, and Safe House Arts at One Grove, a 99-seat performance space here in San Francisco. Safe House is the home of RAW, which is Resident Artist Workshop, SPF, Summer Performance Festival, West Wave Dance Festival, and Central Market Now. Joe has been a producer, curator, choreographer, and performer in the Bay Area for some 25 years, and his choreography has been presented up and down California as well as internationally. In 2012, the San Francisco Bay Guardian honored him with a Goldie Award. Joe, welcome back to Open Air yourself.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir.
I think your introduction has got the record for the most acronyms bio.
We got stuck on acronyms for a while there.
So let's talk about the acronym of SOMA.
Yeah, there you go.
This began as a workshop in progress at ODC, I understand.
Yeah, that was part of the SPF festival. Amy and I locked ourselves into a studio for a few months and hammered out all the raw material and did about a half an hour excerpt in July.
Amy Lewis, so the concept of the show is Joe's or your combined? Actually, you came up with the concept of it.
Yes, this is my concept. This idea started percolating in 2010, where I started wanting to do different pieces on different San Francisco neighborhoods that included a walking tour with a performance piece. And I did one in 2011 called Tread the Tender Knob for Meridian Gallery. And I wanted to do another one on SOMA. And at that point, I was working with Joe at the Garage on Bryant Street, and asked him if he wanted to be involved in a piece about SOMA.
And Joe, you have a personal history and a lot of memories of your time in SOMA.
Yeah, I spent most of my 30s in SOMA, I think, and my 40s probably. It was a little bit of a golden age for that neighborhood, mm-hmm. For the queer community.
Well, let's talk about that, because we're going to talk a little bit about gentrification down the road. But what was the scene like in the 60s?
Well, it was interesting. You know, I wasn't around during the 60s or 70s. I mean, during that period, there were a lot of the leather bars were emerging for the leather culture, and there were a lot of bathhouses. And then the big turning point was around 82, when Feinstein started shutting down a lot of the bathhouses. And then as the internet exploded, a lot of the leather bars started to close during the mid-80s, because a lot of chat rooms and stuff like that was starting to replace some of the bars.
Right.
So, it's been an interesting community to watch it evolve, you know, from the 70s through the early
Well, we've seen neighborhoods change. Gay-centered Polk Street became right. Castro now.
Right.
And edginess has pretty much always been associated with SoMa.
Right.
And I think to a degree it's a kind of a last holdout of
yeah.
that edginess.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's not a lot of neighborhoods that can sort of claim that in San Francisco. And it's sort of a lost generation.
Mm-hmm. So let's... remembering that we're on public radio.
Oh, that's right. That's right. You said delicate. I have to learn how to be delicate all of a sudden. Okay, this is gonna be a challenge.
What sort of activities were you privy to as a young man?
Yeah,
in a sexually liberating area of San Francisco.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that the issue was, the community was sort of divided in two. There was, the men that were very comfortable in the Castro, which was a little bit more heteronormative. A little bit more mainstream. And if you didn't fit into that particular group, I think other men gravitated towards SoMa, which was a little bit edgier, a little bit more alternative. If you were into any particular kind of fetish, you would probably go to the SoMa. You probably wouldn't go to the Castro.
Mm-hmm.
So I think during that generation, I think that... a lot of misfits gravitated towards SoMa that didn't want to fit in. So there were a lot more artists, a lot more underground type people, I think a lot more freedom to express your sexuality than what you experienced in the Castro.
Mm-hmm. Amy Lewis, you created this. You have are you a closet fetishist? Or do we need to talk about why your wonderful
yeah,
interest
Amy,
in gay
tell
men
us.
Having
I'll
gay
say
men?
No comment to that question. I actually
is it more physicality. Are you interested in the buildings of SoMa as opposed to the men having sex in those buildings?
When I start pretty much all my work, I start by gathering research. So I just started with a ton of research. I really didn't know what the focus of the piece was going to be. So I was interested in dislocation. So I started looking at the building of Yerba Buena Center and all the residents that were dislocated in the end of the 60s. And I started looking at the Bay Bridge and the building of the West Approach and how that affected the community and the landscape in SoMa. And I looked at the history and how most of the land there was underwater, and I interviewed Joe. And so I had these different stories that were happening. And actually, it wasn't until recently that I decided to really just focus on the leather culture. And I threw out, and this was even after ODC, I still wanted to add all these other elements, and I just thought, this is just too much. The tapestry is too big. And so I threw out all of this other stuff. So I just felt this was the strongest part of the piece. It addressed dislocation, and it addressed redevelopment, which was also a huge part of why a lot of the leather bars closed. And so as long as those elements were in place for me, I felt satisfied.
And Joe can provide all the details.
And Joe gets to provide all the dirty stuff, the nitty-gritty.
Which we didn't know was going to happen, really. I mean, I think that was a surprise for both of us. Because we were working with the idea of research, and so Amy brought a bottle of red wine and said, I'm going to interview you. And I wasn't really thinking about making a piece. I was just like, oh, I'm just going to fill in my friend on some of the details of the neighborhood. And about a month later, she came back and said, hey, I've got the sound score ready for your solo. And I said... what are you using? And she goes, remember the interview we did? And I said, you're kidding. So it was good we didn't talk about that part, because I probably would have edited myself a lot.
I remember things happening a little bit differently. I do remember there was some discussion before I just threw it at you, but maybe not.
All right. So how it's intended for a mature audience, this walking tour, but... there's nothing explicit going on. Tell us about the dance element that's going to be happening.
Well, the language is explicit.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, because that bottle of red wine, it really served its purpose. Because I was really adamant about making sure that, I think when I was talking to Amy, I was like, okay, I've really got to make sure Amy understands the mechanics of what's happening here, right? And so I ended up being pretty blunt. The dancing is abstracted. We used a lot of improvisational exercises to generate the material, and then Amy took the videotaped the material, and then she deconstructed it and made a deconstructed score, like a collage, which I relearned out of sequence. So the dance is somewhat abstract.
Okay, so tell us some of the stops that we're going to be on this tour.
So we start at the Eagle. There is no performance happening at the Eagle, but we gather there. And I think the Eagle is important because it's been around for such a long time. And then we move to the Powerhouse, which Joe talks about in the text. And there's a some dancing that happens at the Powerhouse. We then move to Brush Place, which is off Hallam Street. And that location was chosen because there was a lot of queer men who were living in that area, which all burned down in 1981. So I wanted to use that area. And then we moved to Harriet Street, which is right across from 1015 Folsom, which used to be a very large bathhouse complex. And then we move to the freeway, under the freeway. And I really wanted to use the freeway because it's this huge icon of SoMa that's been there since 1936. And they had to renovate it after Loma Prieta. So I really, really wanted to use that site. And our final stop is Blow Buddies, which is a sex club. And that is still open. Do you know, Joe, do you remember when it opened?
82, I think.
And it's still open today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the Powerhouse is still open also.
That's right. Excellent. So you're limiting the number of participants on the tour just for crowd control purposes?
Yeah, just so everybody can see. And we have two volunteers on each tour to make sure that everyone's sort of together. And but it's really just more for visual, so that everyone can really see Joe.
Mm-hmm. And are you working on another neighborhood after you've done the Tenderloin, SoMa? What else is intriguing to you?
Well, I would love to. I have a lot of ideas. My next one, I would love to do something in Forest Hill. There's a few Maybeck houses there, and he also designed the Palace of Fine Arts. So I would love to do something in Forest Hill and then have a performance piece at the Palace of Fine Arts. That's kind of, you know, that would be a big project. I would love to use like 25 dancers, and I'd have to get permits and all that stuff.
Well, let me know when that's ready. We'll have you back on, or whatever
you're
doing, whatever you're having next with Push. Great to have you guys on. The SoMa Now and Then began last weekend. Just one more chance, Saturday, December 3rd, and Sunday, the 4th, both starting at 3 o'clock.
This weekend also.
This weekend also?
Yeah, this weekend
great.
Also.
So more information at Safe House Arts. Is that the best place to go?
I know. Push.
Pushproductions.org.
And what Joe's is up to is at Safe House Arts.
Yeah.
Okay, great. And let's see. Well, SoMa Now and Then contains candid language and imagery meant to be observed by mature audiences. There's the other disclaimer. Amy Lewis.
That's right.
Joe Landini, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, from the not-so-kid-friendly event to kid-friendly in the extreme, next here on Open Air. Good morning, Baltimore, from Hairspray. Marquee Productions will present the rousing musical smash hit December 2nd through the 11th at the historic Montgomery Theater in downtown San Jose. Marquee Productions is a division of CMT San Jose, 49 years strong, the longest thriving arts organization in Silicon Valley. In his second decade as artistic director at CMT, Kevin Haughey has led this nation's leading theater company for youth in taking on increasingly challenging and professional quality productions, which has resulted in recognition of artistic excellence from the National Endowment for the Arts for 9 consecutive years. In April, Silicon Valley Creates honored Kevin for lifetime achievement and community impact with their Legacy Laureate Award. Kevin is also a recipient of the prestigious Lynn Wright Special Recognition Award by the American Alliance for Theater and Education and has been guest speaker at the International Association of Theater Educators Conference in Washington and the Education and Technology Conference in New York City. He staged ice shows, magic shows, musical reviews, industrial shows, corporate parties, television specials, and book musicals. And he's also appeared several times as a guest artist with the San Jose Symphony and has served on the Exhibits Committee at the Tech Museum of Innovation. Kevin, such a pleasure to welcome you back to our open airwaves.
We're so happy to be back again. Thank you for having me.
And congratulations again on your Silicon Valley Creates Award back in April. I think that's the last time we spoke.
It is. That was a wonderful evening, and it was a wonderful tribute to the good work that all of us do at CMT San Jose.
Well, let's get people up to speed who aren't familiar with Hairspray.
Hairspray is a musical that was on Broadway in the last decade and won tons of Tony Awards and is based on the John Waters film. It's set in Baltimore in 1962. It's a big, giant, fluffy musical that I love for so many reasons, the first being that the music is such a salute to all of the sounds of the early 60s, the girl groups, the rhythm and blues, all of that sound. I really enjoy that. You know what else I love for that period, too, is all the great dances from back then, the mashed potato and the jerk and the monkey and all of those. And it's an opportunity to teach those steps to a new generation and to bring them to life on stage. It is a very funny show. We could never have known when we selected the show. In the heart of this very entertaining musical is a story of a young girl who's trying to fit in and stands for inclusion and, in particular, really believes in integration and that we are all equal. In today's days and weeks and years, what better time to come together and celebrate us all together in a big, giant, pink musical?
Indeed. Well, tell us about Marquee Productions and how you're involving the alumni of the Children's Theater, as well as, I imagine, some current students.
It's been probably over 10 years now that we've been doing it. It is over 10 years. And we now, twice a year, bring back working actors and alumni to our organization and have them put together a show working at a professional pace. People come as far away as from New York and Los Angeles and Fremont, that far. They've come far and wide to be a part of our productions. They give up their time and their talent for about 4 weeks, and then we put it up for 2 weeks. And it's a way for them to contribute to the programs that we offer for the kids of our area.
Hairspray, based on the film by John Waters, wonderful music the music's by Mark Scheiman with lyrics by Scott Whitman and a book by Mark O'Donnell and Thomas Meehan, has some very timely topics of integration,
right,
of race relations. I think it's the second musical in the Bay Area that may have audiences raising an eyebrow or two. I was just at The King and I last night, where
right,
The King of Siam talks about building a wall.
That's exactly right. Yes, and it's a very interesting time. As you can imagine, in a rehearsal hall, although this is a marquee production, we always cast everything age-appropriate, which means that there are probably 20 people under the age of 21 that are part of the production playing all the roles of the teens. It's nice to be in a room full of African Americans and white kids and white adults and being able to all talk about the words that we're speaking and how have things changed and how have things, even the way you perceive a script that was written 12 years ago and how you perceive it today are very different.
Well, I imagine, too. I mean, you were in rehearsal for this well before the election.
Correct.
I imagine perceptions have changed, too, about maybe even the way people are thinking about their characters.
Correct. Exactly true. And even, I think, certain sentences in it now even have more poignancy. And I think that this cast is ready to get out there and show their point of view and have an opinion. All the while, let me make it clear, it is a big, giant, fun musical for the whole family.
Yeah, yeah. And so tell us a little bit about some of the alumni that came in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Playing the role of Edna is Doug Santana, who grew up in the organization since he was 10 years old. He has traveled the country performing. He's a great director in our area and also an amazing educator at Mitty High School and is the head of the performing arts department there, and we are so happy to have him back on our stage. It's always fun to put people that are mentors in our community up on the stage so that people that are learning from him and others can really feel the impact of what they see on stage. It translates to them hearing in a different way their mentors in the future. And that's true of another one. Ian Leonard is playing the part of Corny Collins. Again, traveled the world, actually, and the country as a performer, is an educator of young people now, has been a part of many of our productions, and is on our stage doing the same thing. I can tell you, too, we have some remarkable leads being played by people that are as young as 18 and 21. And this story is driven by Kirsten Schmall, who's playing the role of Tracy, who grew up in our organization as well, and has really taken the lead in front of this cast of 32 and is leading the charge towards a really beautiful production.
Fantastic. Production runs through the 11th of December. Information at cmtsj.org. Tell us about the who you have in the pit.
Well, we'll have a full orchestra, as we always do, and remember that sort of power of sound that was developed in the early 60s, that really is reflected in the way that the orchestra plays every song that you're going to hear in the show. And it really does help generate remarkable energy with our dancers. And I can assure you, they are all getting a workout.
Kevin Hauge, director of Hairspray, congratulations on your many honors and have a terrific production of Hairspray.
Thank you so much.
Runs through the 11th. Information at cmtsj.org.
Everybody's grooving to a brand new sound. Hey, mama, follow me. I know something's in you that you want to set free. So let go, go, go of the past now. Say hello to the love in your heart. Yes, I know that the world's spinning fast now. You gotta get yourself a brand new start.
Hey, mama, welcome to the 60s. Oh, 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 oh. Oh, mama, welcome to the 60s. Oh, 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 oh.
Boom, boom. Boom, 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 boom.
Santa baby, just slip a sable under the tree for me. Been an awful good girl, Santa baby, so hurry down the chimney tonight.
No better way to kick off the holiday season than with the 2016 edition of the Christmas Ballet, offered by Smuin Contemporary American Ballet, and opening first at the Lesher Center for the Arts, November 18th and 19th in Walnut Creek, before moving on to Carmel in early December, Mountain View mid to 7th through the 11th in Mountain View, and then the 15th through the 24th here in San Francisco. With equal parts sugar and spice, offering something for both the naughty and the nice, this ever-changing visual treat does have something for everyone, from ballet, tap, and swing to a wealth of other dances drawn from holiday traditions around the world. Here to talk about this year's offering is Smuin's choreographer-in-residence, Amy Seiwert, who has worked with her mentor, Michael Smuin, for 8 of her 9 years as a dancer with the company. She danced for 8 years with the Sacramento Ballet before that, and as a choreographer, her collaborations with artists of other disciplines have made her a unique voice in the Bay Area dance community, garnering critical praise far and near. Amy's own group, Imagery, has made quite a splash for itself as well here in the Bay Area. And welcome back to the open airwaves, Amy.
Well, thanks. Glad to be here.
Well, one of the hallmarks of the Christmas ballet is its bifurcation, right? First half on the serious side, second half not so much, with lots of tinsel and snow.
Yes.
Now, there are 3 world premieres this year. Are they happening in the first half or the second half or both?
They're happening in both.
Okay.
So, yes. Well, I have a world premiere happening in the second half, which is the red act, the more naughty one, you might say. And that will be to Joni Mitchell's iconic River, which is...
Oh, man, one of my favorite tunes ever.
Such a fantastic song, and her voice, and just, yes. So And, you know, it's a sad song, so it adds a little bit of heartbreak into to Christmas Ballet. But in a way that's, I think, really beautiful. Yeah, we created it in a really short amount of time. It came together so fast and so seamlessly. And the dancers, that's me, and they're so strong, so wonderful, and such great collaborators that we could really go pretty deep with the creation process really quickly. It was exciting.
Well, how long have you been working with the Smuin folk?
Well, I choreographed my first piece for Smuin for their 10th anniversary season, and that was back when I was dancing in the company. And Michael invited me to make a short fanfare that would open Act 2, and this was of a retrospective, and so all the other works were by him. And he wanted a nod to the future. So he wanted me to represent the future in 5 minutes or less in a fanfare.
All right.
Just a small task, really.
Has it been reprised since?
Actually, it hasn't. And I mean, it's so specific. It's such a, it's such a short piece with so much energy behind it. So I would like for it to be, but it would be a lot to get together for 5 minutes. But yeah, so that was the first piece, and that would have been back in 2004, I think. And I've been working with them, doing about one new piece a year ever since. So that's been great.
Nice. In the introduction, I mentioned that this is an ever-changing incarnation, the Christmas Ballet. That was Michael's intention from the start, wasn't it?
Yeah. So what's great about Christmas Ballet and the way it's really been able to continue to grow, even, you know, after Michael has passed, he created this beautiful framework for the piece. And everything we do as the guest choreographers coming in and making new works for it still fits within that frame. So it's great when you're creating a, I sometimes hear Michael's voice in my head when I create. And very often when I'm creating for Christmas Ballet, because there's so much of him already in what you're doing and how you fit inside that frame. So, you know, Amy London, the ballet master for Smuin, who is brilliant, but she and I will always, you know, I'll tell her, you know, Michael's complaining that that lift's not on center, or Michael wants that more downstage. When we were making this one, there was a moment when I looked at her and she said, "Michael is smiling." I was like, yeah, he likes that choice a lot. So in within the Christmas Ballet, so you have Act 1 and you have Act 2, and a lot of things have stayed the same through the years. You know, Santa Baby's never going to go away. That piece is always going to be in there. It's so iconic. It's so brilliantly done. Michael hit it out of the park with that one. But then each year, Celia, the artistic director, will decide which pieces to maybe put on the back burner for a couple years, bring in something new, maybe bring back something that hasn't been done for 5 years. So every year it's different. Every year it's got a different energy. It's got a different flow, a different pace. And I think that keeps it really fresh for audiences. So even if you've seen it 4 times, you're going to see something you've never seen before, or maybe something that you've missed.
It was nice to talk with Celia Fuschiel earlier this season about the opening of the Smuin's season. So talk to me a little bit more about what's going to happen in the first half. I understand there's a new work by dancer Rex Wheeler as well, isn't he?
Yes. So Rex, I've actually known Rex a long time. He used to dance in Sacramento Ballet after I danced there, and he came to Smuin a couple years ago. And he is a very talented creative voice. Actually, Sel's got, you know, quite a few dancers there who are young creative dance makers. And she gives them opportunities, which is great. I've been gone for the last 2 weeks, so I haven't seen what Rex has been cooking up. So I will actually see that on Wednesday for the first time.
Oh, great. And are there some new faces in the ballet that you're working with this year?
I believe Smuin has 5 new dancers this year. So a lot of new, in a small company, that's a big shift. And I'm going to really miss a couple of the older dancers who have moved on to different things, but there are some beautiful new ones. So,
And then in the second half, the more sassy side of things, what are we going to see this year?
Well, you'll see I'm doing River. Ben Needham Wood, who is another young choreographer who does some great stuff, is re-envisioning the closing White Christmas, and I'm not sure what he has planned for that. And then Nicole Haskins is also doing a new piece, and I actually don't know what she's doing.
Well, you'll find out Wednesday.
I will.
Well, you're off to Walnut Creek for performances on the 18th, 19th to get things started at the Lesher Center, and then in Carmel on the 2nd and 3rd of December at the Sunset Center on San Carlos Street, 7th to the 11th of December in Mountain View at the Mountain View Center for the Performing Arts, and then landing back here with a sigh and hopefully some maybe a blister or two for the 15th to the 24th. Here in San Francisco at the wonderful Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. Now, next March, you're going to have a premiere of with the St. Louis Ballet, set to music of Hildegard von Bingen. Wonderful.
Yes. Yeah, that's actually, I just came back from there yesterday, so a little bit jet-lagged. But yeah, it's great. I'm new to her music, and I was asked to pick specifically a female composer, so I was looking at a bunch of different wonderful contemporary female composers, and I came across a piece. I was at a performance of the Oakland Ballet, and Janice Garrett and Charlie Moulton, two beautiful choreographers, had done a piece to her music, and I was like, who is this? And it's my husband is a musician, and he's like, what do you mean you haven't heard of her? And I just started researching her, and I mean, I love the music and I love her story, and I mean, talk about, you know, a strong female woman making a difference, you know, very early on. I definitely was inspired by her life and her music. So
We'll look forward to hearing from you about that maybe in the spring. And there's also this summer, there's a great profile of you in the San Jose Mercury News. Folks can search the mercurynews.com site for that little profile. And I understand you said some music of William Walton's Facade.
Well, that was actually, my company did that, but that was actually done by Val Canaparelli when he came in and worked with imagery for Sketch last summer. And we did a piece the evening was based on ballets made by text, and that was Val's contribution.
We'll talk about that afterwards. What's coming up after that with imagery for you then?
Well, next summer, Imagery will keep doing our sketch series, which will be now in its 7th year. And with the sketch series, each choreographer is asked to self-identify a risk and start creation outside of their comfort zone. So next year, I'm going to take on all the risk myself, and I'm going to do my first ever full evening work.
Wow, fantastic.
It's terrifying, yes. And then the great thing is we'll be doing that at the Cal Theater in July, and then we'll be taking it on the road. We've been invited back to the Joyce Theater in New York, so we'll be there the week after we premiere the work here.
Terrific. You can keep up with Imagery and Amy Seiwert at her website, amyseiwert.com. That's S-E-I-W-E-R-T.com. And, of course, the iconographic Smuin Contemporary American Ballet, the Christmas Ballet. Learn more about the performances in Walnut Creek, Carmel, Mountain View, and San Francisco at their website, smuinballet.org. Let's hear that iconic Joni Mitchell River tune as I say goodbye to Amy and invite her back soon. Thanks for coming in, Amy.
And thanks for having me.
It's coming on Christmas. They're cutting down trees. They're putting up reindeer and singing songs of joy and peace. Oh, I wish I had a river I could skate away on. But it don't snow here, it stays pretty green. I'm gonna make a lot of money, then I'm gonna quit this crazy scene. I wish I had a river I could skate away on. I wish I had a river so long I would teach my feet to fly.
Joni Mitchell and the River, to be choreographed by Amy Seward as part of the Smuin Ballet. Good afternoon, David LaTulipe with now Peter Robinson, who's going to offer us some other holiday suggestions here in the Bay Area. Hi, Peter.
Yeah, hi, David. Yeah, good to be here. And just before I come up with some of the offerings available for the festive season, let me say a word about White Christmas. And I'm sure that we've heard the song during the sales here, there, and everywhere. And to me, the operative word in this song is the word dream. And I say that because it was actually written in 1937 by Irving Berlin as a spoof at a poolside party in Los Angeles, outside temperature 80 degrees. So dreaming of a white Christmas must have been on Irving Berlin's mind. Yeah, perhaps he goes back to his adopted city, New York, or even more likely to Siberia, where he was born in 1888. But come what may, White Christmas is with us, and ever since 1942, when Bing Crosby first introduced it in the movie Holiday Inn, it has sold and sold and sold well over 100 million copies. Now, for my own choice of word, I actually like the word Yuletide. It's an old Norse word talking about Saturnalia and, of course, comes with a Yule log. But I do enjoy the season of Christmas and I enjoy the festivities, and I have a couple of things that are always on my list. And first is A Christmas Carol. It's playing at ACT. It opens on November the 25th, runs until the 24th. And I've got a couple of tips this year if you are going to it, and particularly if you're taking kids or children to it. There's a new edition of Christmas Carol just come out. It's published by W.W. Norton, sells at $21. It has an excellent introduction by the Irish writer Colm Toyman, and it is the annotated text, so you get the full story, but you also get Dickens' original manuscript on the left-hand side of each page, and you can see his handwriting, you can see the changes.
I should mention also, Peter, that if you're in New York City and during holiday time, the Morgan Library always puts on a display of one of Dickens' original works of Christmas Carol, and you see the same. It's fascinating to see all this crossouts and his own.
Yeah, and that's actually from which this edition was taken. So it is there. So as it begins, Marley was dead to begin with. There was no doubt whatever about that. The register of his burial was signed by the clergyman, the clerk, the undertaker, and the chief mourner. Scrooge signed it, and Scrooge's name was upon change for anything he chose to put his hand to. Old Marley was as dead as a doornail. So there we go. Before the ghost arrives, you're suddenly set in this setting. And at ACT, Carrie Perloff, I've seen it over the years, just does a wonderful production in taking you into that sense of a impoverished Christmas and then a story of redemption, spiritual change, and the happiness at the end of Scrooge's final turnaround. So that's a great way to begin the season. And I think one advantage of reading the book, again, introduced by Colin Toynbee, is that it gives you some experience as to what Dickens was going through himself. Even though he'd had success with Pickwick Papers and other books, he was having a hard time that Christmas, and he had to bang out a new story, and that's how we finally got Christmas Carol. So second on my list for this time of year is The Nutcracker. I think this is a great way of introducing young people both to Tchaikovsky and also to ballet. And, of course, with that famous dance, the dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy, we hear that instrument called the celestra. It's like a very classic...
Celeste, okay.
We have arguments about the A at the end, but we're going to go with celeste today. And that is a very glossy or glassy type of piano, which, of course, gets everybody's attention. And of course, Tchaikovsky, I think, had these other ballets, but this is a good introduction. The Nutcracker is a great story, and I think if you want to get people interested in the arts, interested in dancing, interested in music, this to me is always a must-see. Now, tonight I haven't seen it, but I am off to Cirque du Soleil. It's the opening night, and I think this again has got a Mexican theme from what I understand. But if you want to respect what the human body can get up to, the acrobatics, the typewriting, the whole nature of how you put music and body and bring the spirit together, I think the training that these performers go through is just a marvel. So that is, again, a different type of variation. It is running throughout the holiday season, so there's many opportunities to see Cirque du Soleil, and it's down there at the ATM Park, down there just past the Embarcadero. And finally, something slightly different. It's a movie, but it's a movie based on a play which is currently still playing in London. It's called The Entertainer, and I've mentioned before that the National Theatre have this new way of photography, of screening, so you actually feel, although you're in a cinema, that you're in the theatre itself. This is playing at different places. The Embarcadero is one. The Lark Theatre in Marin, they have to have a special type of projectors to produce this. And this is based on a play which John Osborne wrote in 1957. The Entertainer is the title. It's about the demise of music hall, the end of vaudeville. And in the original production, which I saw, Laurence Olivier played Archie Rice, who's the key performer. In this one, Kenneth Branagh is back in action on stage playing the Archie Rice character. And people who remember Downton Abbey may recognize Sophie McShearer. She was Daisy in Downton Abbey, and she too has a leading part. So this is a different type of theatre. It's a, when I call it a nostalgic piece, it marks really the end of music hall, but in a bigger context, what I call the demise of the British Empire. It came after Suez. They've kind of updated it a little bit to include Brexit in this particular production, which you may get the analogies to. But I think it's a timely piece of theatre illustrating how the arts and how the theatre can give us a different perspective about the world in which we're living and the changes in which we are all experiencing.
And we were all escaping to over these next 4 years, no doubt, in droves. The arts will help us through.
Yeah, but I want to finish with one personal moment of sadness, regret, and that is to pay tribute to Gwen Ifill, the PBS newsar. I'm going to say reader, but much more. The one thing which always came across to me was not just her voice, but her smile. She lit up the screen. She had the gravitas to our serious questions, but she also put things in, I think, the best and most optimistic life. So to me, Gwen Ifill is a sad loss this week, somebody who spoke to me, even though I was only watching her through a television screen.
Thank you very much for that, Peter. In memory of Gwen Ifill. That's Open Air for this week. I'm David LaTulip. Join me again next week at the same time, and join me Monday evening at 9 for Explorations in Music with Robert Greenberg and the Alexander String Quartet. Open Air is produced by Niels Swinkels. If you've got a segment suggestion, by all means, send me an email, david@kalw.org. And our shows are archived at our website, kalw.org. Thanks for listening.